Hi, Rabbi Geffen asked me starting on Sunday to learn Megillas Esther for a few weeks till Purim. So once again, to be a digression from our official subject, but that'll be starting, God willing, on Sunday. Today, hold on, I could obviously spend more sessions than one on it. I just want to talk about one final aspect. This really is connected to the issues of integrating secular law and religious law. And I'd like to talk briefly about a particular issue of family law, where this has been very painful, but also very important, and that is the issue of the aguna. An aguna is a Hebrew word, an Aramaic word, that simply means an anchored woman, a woman who is unable to marry because her husband has refused to give her a religious divorce that is called a get. And here, let's just review some of the basic halachas, which I'm sure are familiar to many of you, but just to be sure everyone understands the basic idea. Under the law of the Torah, once a woman is halachically married, that marriage can never be terminated unless she receives a get. Now, what is a get? A get is a piece of paper. It's written in Aramaic by a sofer, by a scribe, and the husband or his shaliach, his agent, gives it to the wife or her shaliach. You can actually have, husband's agent giving it to wife's agent. And at that moment, the woman is divorced and she is permitted to marry anybody she wants other than a kohen, of course, because a kohen cannot marry a divorced woman. Now, if a woman marries or has relations with a man prior to her receiving the get, she has committed adultery. Even if there's a civil divorce, she has violated the issur of adultery, number one. And number two, any child that she has from that adulterous union, that child is called a mamzer. Now again, the halacha should be understood that a kid that is born out of wedlock is not a mamzer. Man and woman have premarital sex, as improper as that is. The child has no disability, the child is not a mamzer. But if a married woman, and that, by that I mean a halachically married woman, has relations with a man, whether the man is married or single, the child is a mamzer. And what is a mamzer? Mamzer is a Jewish child, of course, but a mamzer has some very severe marital disabilities. A mamzer cannot marry any other Jewish person except another woman or man who is a mamzer, a mamzeres, or they can also marry a converted Jew, a Jew by choice. However, the problem is, whoever the mamzer marries, whether a mamzer marries a mamzeres or a mamzer marries a giyores, the child will still be a mamzer. And as a result, the cycle will continue forever in terms of creating this stigma and limitation. Now, the only way, there is one way a mamzer could break the chain. Now, this is presently not a halakhically permissible way, and that is if a male mamzer marries a non-Jewish woman, not a convert, a non-Jewish woman, an intermarriage, which is, of course, totally forbidden. It's forbidden. But under the rule of matrilineal descent, if the mother is a guy, the kid is a guy. If the kid then converts to Judaism, since conversion severs and erases all pre-existing conditions, so the pains of being born from adultery no longer attaches, and as a result, therefore, a male mamzer could theoretically remove the taints from his children by marrying a guy. But I want to emphasize, this is not a permissible solution. A mamzer is not allowed to marry a guy. Now, if a mamzer marries a converted woman, that doesn't help, because the kid will still be a mamzer. Right now, I'm sorry.
I wanted to go back and ask you one question.
Yeah, sure.
One possibility.
Sure.
A married man has an adulterous relation with an unmarried.
Yes.
The child is not a mamzer.
That's correct. That's why it's very, very precise. The only way a child could be a mamzer out of incest too, which is less common, Baruch Hashem. But in terms of adultery, the only way a mamzer is produced halachically is if the woman is married and has relationships with a man other than her husband. If a man is married and has relationships with a single woman, that is not biblical adultery for a very simple reason. Under Torah law, a man could have two wives. A man could have another wife. Therefore, it's not adultery. It is true that it's under the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom. Polygamy is no longer permitted, but that's a rabbinic ban. That does not create mamzer or anything of that nature. Now, the issue of aguna, therefore, is a real problem when a man refuses to give a woman a get. Why would a man refuse to give a woman a get? He might refuse for a lot of reasons. He might say, I don't want to give you a get unless you pay me $100,000. That's one reason, money. It's done. A man might say, let's assume they're disagreeing over child support. The woman wants a certain amount of money every week for her support. The husband says, well, unless you lower your request or don't ask for anything, I'm not giving you a get. Or it may come up as child custody, right, where the man wants to have his kids more often. The woman says no. The judge may side with the woman, the judge or the basin, I should say, whoever is deciding it. But the man has this leverage. He has this knife, this sword of Damocles, as it were, over the a woman saying, you either agree to what I want, or I won't give you a get. Sometimes it's done out of pure malice or spite. In Israel, for example, a common reason why women are agunot is because their husbands are already in prison for murder or something like that, and they just don't want to give their wives a get. Right, so the issue of an aguna is a very, very serious problem. Now, I do want to mention, and I think we talked about this before, but it's important, that I've been describing the aguna as the bad husband who doesn't want to give his wife a get. But keep in mind that many cases of mamzer do not come from evil intention, but they come from carelessness and ignorance. Consider a very, very simple situation that every Baal Tshuva in the world faces on a regular basis, one of the most difficult questions. Imagine a kid who is the child of a second marriage. And the first, coming from a non-religious home. So the mother's first marriage was not terminated by a get. The mother and father, or the mother and her first husband, terminated their marriage by civil divorce. Mother then marries another man in the Jewish ceremony, has a kid. 25 years later, the kid is met by Jeff Seidel at the Western Wall, or Mayor Schuster or somebody, and becomes a real frum guy. And he learns real well, so after 3 years in Or Sameach, Hareish HaTorah, it's time for Shiduchim. Time to get married, right? So people start proposing nice Shiduchim. Rish Hashem, everyone who's not yet there should be there soon. But all of a sudden, it's now important. What was not important for 25 years, you know, some mom had a first husband and they got civilly divorced before I was born. Do you realize the potential impact of what's going on right now? And that is, all of a sudden, this kid realizes that if he was born from a second union where the first marriage was not terminated by a get, he, chas v'shalom, might be a mamzer who can't marry anybody except another mamzeres or a gioris, and whoever child they have is going to be a mamzer.
Marriage has to be a holy kosher marriage, right?
Right, right. So this is going to be, right, so this is a very, very important issue. So,
which one?
Gioris. Converted, in other words. A mamzer could marry a converted Jew. A ger. Gioris just means a female ger. But still, the kids are going to be mamzerim. Okay? So here, we have a very, very important psak of Rav Moshe Feinstein. And Rav Moshe Feinstein rules, in a way it's very, very logical, Rav Moshe Feinstein rules that in order to require a get, it's essential that the marriage be halachically valid. If a marriage is not halachically valid, it's not a marriage, you don't need a get because they weren't married to begin with. Now that's not Rav Moshe's chiddush, that's obvious. If they're not married, you don't need a get. Now, what makes a marriage halachically kosher? Right? What is the irreducible minimum? Right? You don't need a fancy wedding hall. You don't need to break a glass.
Doesn't
have to be a silver ring.
Well, it has to be a ring of some value. Two kosher witnesses.
Right. So the concept would be the concept would be you got to give. There are three ways actually, but the most common way is you got to give the value of a penny, or a pruta as it's called, to the woman, right? So you'd be surprised how little you can get away with. You don't need a gold ring or anything like that. A penny. Pull out a penny, you know. Pull out a half agura, not a half agura, it would be half a shekel. So here, take it, you know. Get yourself a ring. Don't spend it in one place. Okay, so you can give money's worth. You must declare, in English or Hebrew, language to the effect, I am marrying you with this. Doesn't have to be the exact words. And it must be done in the presence, not necessarily of a rabbi, it must be done in the presence of two kosher witnesses. Now, what are kosher witnesses? There are many, many halachos as to who is a kosher witness. The kosher witnesses must be men. Happens to be the halacha. They cannot be related to each other. They cannot be related to the chasan or the kala. Again, I mean, we're not referring to third cousins twice removed, but you know, there are certain direct relationships. So they have to be men, not related, and most importantly and most difficult, they themselves have to be halachically observant individuals in order to be kosher witnesses. Now, by halachically observant, we mean that they must be Shomer Shabbos, and they must observe the laws of kashrus, you know, the very basic laws. If they're married, they must observe the laws of family purity. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein says that given the fact that most people who were married in the conservative or reform movements probably did not have kosher witnesses at their ceremonies. See, it's not because it's in a reform temple or a reform rabbi. That's not the issue. Theoretically, a reform rabbi's marriage could be 100% valid. But based on the definition of witnesses, you probably did not have kosher witnesses. Yeah.
The rabbi
has to witness. The rabbi could. See, a witness is whoever the parties say should be witnesses. See, if you're... Yes, that's right. If you just because you're a religious guy who happens to be at some wedding doesn't make you a witness unless you were told to be the witness. So the designated witnesses are usually, not always the case, but usually, they're not halakhically observant within this narrow definition. So consequently, Rav Moshe's argument is the vast bulk of first marriages in the context of the Baal Tshuva were not halakhically valid. And if they weren't halakhically valid, they didn't need a get. And if they didn't need a get, then the second marriage out of which this kid was born, adulterous. And if the second marriage is not adulterous, the kid is not a mamzer. Now, it might very well be, don't mistake it, it might very well be that the same logic that said the first marriage is invalid might say the second, but you see, that's not a problem. It might indeed say the second marriage is invalid, but so what? The most that's going to do, so that's the critical thing, the most that's going to do is make the Baal Tshuva the product of a halachic out of wedlock relationship. But that's okay. In other words, it may not be okay for his parents. The parents should be encouraged to have a kosher wedding, but he's not going to be a mamzer. See, this is why this is often misunderstood. I'll tell you a letter that appeared in the New York Times, a very, very bitter denunciation in the middle of the 1980s. This involved a young woman. She was 18 or 20 at the time, and she was writing about how the Orthodox rabbinate of Israel, the chief rabbinate in Israel, only cares about their own, and they don't care about any victims they leave in the wake of their halachic decisions against the non-Orthodox. And this involved, this was the Maisa. And the woman had, like, you know, she had an op-ed in the New York Times. It wasn't even a letter to the editor. It was a whole column about, you know, it's time for the Orthodox to care about other people. She was a product of a first marriage. And her sister, her half-sister, was the product of a second marriage of her mother. And the half-sister became religious. And she went to Israel. And there was some question about whether she was allowed to marry because she was born from a second marriage and the first marriage didn't have a get. So the Israeli chief rabbinate, Paskins, like Rav Moshe's Psak, that she's not a mamzer because, in effect, the first marriage was not halachically valid because you didn't have kosher witnesses. So this is what the girl says at the first marriage. Says, so just because my sister is Orthodox, so they're perfectly willing to make her okay by turning me into a mamzer. In other words, they declare that the marriage of my mother and my father, you know, was a halachic nullity, and they make me a mamzer. But that's okay because I'm not Orthodox, So they're perfectly happy to make me a mamzer. Now, you see, the fallacy here is that it obviously does not make her a mamzer. And in fact, it's true that it makes her an out of wedlock, but it makes her sister out of wedlock too from the second marriage. In other words, it puts her and her sister on exactly the same. Now, the truth of the matter is, the Reform movement initially was extremely critical of Rav Moshe's arguments because because obviously it smacks of delegitimation of a movement. But on the other hand, and again, Rav Moshe did not view the world in political terms. Rav Moshe called the halacha as he saw the halacha. But on the other hand, from a sociological perspective, if we could talk about it this way, this was a real, real lifesaver for hundreds and hundreds of people who would otherwise be stigmatized with the issue of mamzer. So, again, I'm not suggesting for a moment that Rav Moshe bent the halacha to achieve a good result. That is not the way a posek works. But you see that a Gadol B'Torah is able to understand the halacha in a way that does help benefit Klal Yisrael.
So we have an obligation to check? Like, I understand, like, if you don't know, then it's not, but like, if it's possible to find it out, you have an obligation?
If it's possible to find out, there would be an obligation. I'll give you a case that I was involved in a few years ago. And this was very much removed from Rav Moshe's case, but you see how the Poskim have to extend it. This also involved a boy from a second marriage whose mother's first marriage did not have a get. Now the problem was this. The problem was that the first marriage, which was all the way back in 1951, okay, this is the first marriage. The first marriage was actually performed by an Orthodox cousin in Massachusetts, an Orthodox cousin. So, and nobody was alive, or nobody, we couldn't find anybody who knew anything about what happened in 1951. There were no guests that were still alive or anything else. The only thing we had going for us was a statement by an Orthodox rabbi with whom the chazan worked, who said to the effect that if this chazan made a wedding, he couldn't have gotten any Shomer Shabbos from our shul because nobody in shul talked to him, because the chazan was unpopular in the shul, and therefore we can assume that if he got anybody to show up at a wedding with him, they were not Shomer Shabbos. Now, that's not, you know, any type of testimony at all, but essentially that's all we had. And I was involved because this happened in Massachusetts, but the old elderly rabbi who knew that people weren't talking to this cousin 40 years ago, he happened to have come to Silver Spring in his retirement. So I was kind of in charge of taking the testimony, like a deposition, and then presenting it to the rabbis in Israel, the rabbanut, for their decision. So the rabbanut, the Israeli chief rabbinate's office, didn't want to paskin on it because it was a very severe issue. Because here you don't really have any clear evidence that there was no... Well, so they wanted to go to Rebbe Yashiv. It's interesting, Rebbe Yashiv has a very interesting relationship with the rabbanut. Because on one level, you know, Rebbe Yashiv, you've heard of Rebbe Yashiv, the great posek, great halachic authority in Yerushalayim. Rebbe Yashiv used to work for the rabbanut in the old days, you know, many, many years ago in the 60s, but you know, he left the rabbanut, and essentially he's not aligned with the rabbanut or with the Zionist state or whatever it is. He's kind of outside of that. But the rabbanut still uses him as their consultant privately for the most difficult questions. And we went to Rebbe Yashiv. It was very interesting. She asked to meet Rebbe Yashiv. I never met Rebbe Yashiv before. He talks very, very fast. It's extremely difficult to understand him. You know, and my Yiddish isn't so great anyway. And you come in, and there's a line of like 100 people waiting to see him. So everybody gets their 1 minute, you know, to say what they want to say. So when I told him this, you know, he looked at me like this was like, you know, the sixth time we got this question. Oh, another one of those mantra questions. Okay. But he said that he would allow the rabbanut to say that the person is not a mamzer, to give such a prasad. But he did not want to publicly sign a letter to that effect. Again, in the mysterious world of psak halacha, you sometimes get what are called, you know, black market psak in some way. In other words, Rav Yashiv said, because you have to understand it, in other words, a posek has a very difficult issue here, because indeed there is a chiyuv to try to look for some leniency, to try to look for some way to give the person the possibility of not being stigmatized. But you can't just kind of say, yeah, let's throw out the halakha. You have to work within the principle. And here, Rav Yashiv was willing to accept the fact that if indeed this was a small, semi-rural community in Massachusetts, of which there was only a handful of Shomer Shabbos anyway. Now, the Chazan is already one Shomer Shabbos person. So he was one, but he's number not two. And we have evidence that the few Shomer Shabbos people in that community didn't talk to this person and would never participate with him. So even though there was no direct testimony as to what happened at that wedding, Rav Yashiv said, for that already, it's permitted for us to be lenient. So you see that this is a tremendously difficult issue. Yeah.
Is there some sort of form or something that you have to fill out to say that this guy, this guy is the official witness?
No, what happens basically is that under the chuppah, the bride and the groom will be asked, whom do you want to designate as your witnesses? And you say, I designate Reuven and Shimon as my witnesses. It's usually an honor. I mean, an Orthodox wedding at least, one of the honors you give to your friends would be to say, I want you to be my witnesses under the chuppah. Now, of course, sometimes in the case of, sometimes people have a different attitude. Sometimes people say instead of getting their friends to be witnesses, they want to get, like, the rabbis to be witnesses, just to be sure that you have a kosher witness, so to speak. Well, not every rabbi is kosher either, but okay, yeah.
I don't have to jump too far ahead, but it's my understanding that in the conservative movement today, it's required that every ketubah have a clause saying that a get shall, you know, basically, I guess, be automatically granted in the event of a divorce. And I guess there's a halachic objection in the Orthodox movement that it's right. Objectionable. Could you tell me?
Yeah, but I'll get to that. That's what I'll get to. Yeah, I'll talk about that a little bit.
In a case where you're, say your parents are still together,
yes,
and they've never been separated,
right?
But you're wondering if the original marriage was,
yes,
according to halacha. Is there any reason that you need to find this out, or is it an irrelevant fact?
It's not relevant to you. It does not affect you at all. So you could say it's none of my business. On the other hand, it would be a mitzvah for your parents to have a halachically valid ceremony. So it doesn't affect you in any way. But you know, this happens all the time. There are plenty of couples. Let's take a regular case. A husband and wife have been living together for 20 years. They decide to become Shomer Shabbos. They have to be remarried. Now, how do you remarry them? It's not a big deal, basically. You get a ksuva, which you can buy in a Jewish bookstore for $5. Ksuva. You fill in the name. You know, a rabbi would fill in the names and the dates and everything. And you get a minyan together. And the chassan, father, the older chassan, would give a ring to the kala in the presence of two kosher witnesses with a new kesuva that is signed by two kosher witnesses, and they are married. You will also recite sheva brachos under the chuppah, but you wouldn't have 7 days of rejoicing, but you would have the one sheva brachos recited once under the chuppah. So I myself have officiated on many, many remarriages. Probably 10 times. So this happens. But in terms of, you know, your immediate problem, it is not no immediate problem for the child. But it's just, it's a mitzvah on the parents to come together.
Yeah. Isn't there a case as well for special circumstances when two people are going into a room in the presence of witnesses that they consider married?
Well, this is the thing. Rav Moshe's psak, it was not universally accepted, which is interesting that it's now become, I think because of the so many Baalei Tshuva who face this problem, the consensus of halakha has been to be more lenient. But Rav Henkin, for example, who was a great posek, contemporary of Rav Moshe, actually disagreed with Rav Moshe for the following reason. Rav Henkin made the argument that even if the original giving of the ring was not halakhically valid because there weren't kosher witnesses, but the parties later live as man and wife, including marital intimacy. And according to the Mishnah in Kiddushin, you can make a marriage not merely by giving the ring, you can also make the marriage by the act of intercourse later on. Aye, but you'll say, where are the witnesses? Well, the halacha is, in terms of witnesses for intercourse never see the intercourse. It's simply their knowledge that man and wife are intimate. So consequently, Rav Henkin argued, if there were any Shomer Shabbos people who were aware that Reuven and Sarah were living as man and wife. They would become the witnesses who would validate the marriage. So Rav Henkin argued at a later point, therefore, in fact, this is the same, this is, by the way, this is not only true for reformed marriages, this is true for civil marriages and the like. In other words, Rav Henkin made the argument that even a civil marriage that was physically consummated, and Kal v'chomer, reform or conservative marriage, required a get towards dissolution. See, that's that was Rav Henkin's point. And Rav Elyashiv, for many years, essentially always followed Rav Henkin's psak, but I think it was surprising that now he's following Rav Moshe. Now, even Rav Moshe would admit, if it's possible to get a get before a remarriage, we try to do that. But Rav Moshe is talking about the Yevid, you know, after the fact, when you already have all the Imam Zerim. So, in effect, many cases of Mamzer can be addressed by Rav Moshe Feinstein's psak, but not all cases, because in some of these cases, the first marriage is an Orthodox marriage, right? The first marriage of an, right? In other words, you may have a frum guy that's refusing to give his wife a get. And when you have a religious guy who's not giving his wife a get, you have a real problem, because you can't go back and say, hey, there must be, the marriage wasn't halachically valid. So the question then becomes, what can be done for these women? Now here it's very important to point out that there is a fundamental difference between the United States and Israel in terms of the legal avenues that are available. And that is to say, in Israel, marriage and divorce under secular, under the law of the Knesset, marriage and divorce is under the jurisdiction of the rabbinical courts of the State of Israel. The rabbinical courts, of course there are many Batei Din that are not associated with the state, the Badatz, for example, but within the Rabbanut structure, the rabbinical courts of the Rabbanut are part of the legal arm of the State of Israel. Meaning that if a Beit Din of the Rabbanut orders a husband to give a get to his wife under religious law, and a man refuses to obey the order of that Beit Din, the man can be sent to jail. The man can be imprisoned for failure to carry out the order of a legally constituted court of the State of Israel. So, in Israel, there is a legal ability to enforce the decision of a Beit Din to give a get, and that can result in imprisonments. In the United States, where a Beis Din doesn't have any authority legally, even if a Beis Din orders a man to give a get, what if the man says no? What's the Beis Din going to do? There's not too much. So one might say, I'll come back to that, one might say, therefore, that in Israel the aguna problem should be much less, at least if you know where the husband is. Sometimes whether you don't know where the husband is, and the Rabbanut has a very nice detective office, as it were, which traces people in South America and Australia and all sorts of places. Eli Ben-Dahan is a very capable, he's the administrator of the court system, and he has a whole office to find people. But let's assume we know where the husband is. So basically, in Israel, there is at least a legal mechanism of imprisonment. However, even in Israel, this mechanism breaks down very, very often, and there are at least two reasons why it breaks down. Reason number one is, for some men, imprisonment simply doesn't make a difference. For example, consider the fact that many of the guys who are not giving their wives gittin are already serving life terms for murder or rape. Now, if a guy is serving a life term for murder or rape, what worse can you do to him for not giving a get? Now, some rabbanim have advocated that the Knesset pass a law authorizing beating. But nevertheless, that's not... Well, the halacha permits it. The halacha clearly would permit it. The halacha does permit a person to be beaten until he says, I want to give the get. If the Beis Din has ordered it, that is. But under the laws of the Knesset, the maximum penalty for somebody is imprisonment. And in fact, there was a story in Time magazine a few years ago that a guy who was under order to give a get to his wife languished in jail 30 years in refusing to give the get to his wife. He finally died. Of course, at that point, she was free to marry, but at that point, it was not, it was not her interest or her ability. In fact, this is the story of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, the great Rabbi Akiva Eiger, that Rabbi Akiva Eiger once called a man in who refused to give a get to his wife and said, hey, you ever learned the Mishnah in Kedushin? The Mishnah in Kedushin says a woman acquires her freedom by a get or by death of the husband. Which way do you choose to give your wife this freedom? You have two ways. And he stormed out angrily, and he tripped, and he broke his head on a rock, and he died. So that was Rabbi Akiva Eiger's way of dealing with the Aguna issue, but still, the imprisonment doesn't always work. Yeah?
Doesn't the beating him only work if only say this really deep down you want us to? So
yes.
What about a case where he still loved his wife or something, and the wife wanted a divorce, and she didn't? Would they still allow him?
Yes, that's a very excellent point. I'll get to that in a moment. Now, the second reason why the imprisonment doesn't always work is, you'll notice I was very careful to say that halacha and Israeli law permit imprisonment only when a Beit Din has come to a determination that the husband has an obligation. Not automatically mean she is halakhically entitled to the divorce. There have to be, well, except according to the Rambam, I should say, the Rambam's opinion, by the way, is, which is not followed by halakha, but a very interesting opinion, the Rambam's opinion is if a woman says, I can't stand the guy, she's entitled to a divorce right away. That's the Rambam's opinion. But the halakha does not follow that by and large. The halakha requires that there be some grounds or legitimation for her claim. So allegations of abuse, things like that, including emotional abuse. In other words, she has to show that he's behaving in a rotten, indecent way. She can't just say irreconcilable differences. Now here's the thing. If in fact she does not have halachic grounds to demand a divorce, then any coercion directed against the husband would not only be illegal under Israeli law, but the get that would be procured would be invalid, because a coerced get is not valid unless it's pursuant to the decision of a Beis Din, because the Rambam gives the reason, because deep down every person wants to obey that, the law of the Beis Din, so even if we force him, it's what he really wants to do. So basically it would depend on grounds. Now, here is where I have a problem with the Beis Din system. The Beis Dins in Israel are very, very reluctant to ever come to a clear-cut decision that the woman is entitled to a divorce. They'll say things like, you ought to divorce your wife, it's the nice thing to do. But to say the magic words, you are chayav to divorce your wife. See why those are magic words? Because those are the magic words that will trigger the imprisonment sanctions and everything else. The courts are very reluctant because the courts kind of take the position, well, we really never really know who's at fault here. We never really know, is it the husband's fault or is it the wife's fault? And the unwillingness, and I'm saying this as a criticism of the Beis Din system, the unwillingness of what they did to make a definitive determination as to who's at fault means that even in Israel, where the Beis Din has a tremendous power to deal with the Aguna problem, only like 5% of the cases that come before them result in imprisonment against recalcitrant husbands. So those are the two reasons why even in Israel there's an Aguna problem. One is some guys are already in jail, so it's not going to do anything to them. And the other is the reluctance of many judges on the Beis Din to find, even if a woman could show abuse, but they say, well, we really don't know, you know, this and that. Now, it depends on the situation. For example, although we hate to say this, but this is what women say, there are certain dayanim in Yerushalayim in particular who are much more sensitive to seeing the abuse and the way women are mistreated. And therefore, lawyers will frankly tell women, try to get your case in front of Rav Batsri. Rav Batsri is the Sephardic Dayan. He's the head judge right now of the Yerushalayim Beis Din. He's one of the Chashuv Dayanim. He is said to be, you know, to be willing to make these positions. Other Dayanim don't, you know. And it's a strange thing, because you have to understand that what is called abuse and what is called cruelty and what is called all of these bad things are to some degree culturally determined as well, meaning to say from certain Sephardic countries hitting a wife on occasion was considered to be not so bad. Among Ashkenazim, the Rama writes that it is unheard of for a Jew in Poland or Russia to raise his hand to his wife. So you could see, depending on the cultural milieu, in other words, the halachic standard is one halachic standard. That is, you know, if she is abused, if she is mistreated, if she is being attacked, she has a right to a get. That's the standard. But how that is interpreted can indeed differ in different basements, and that creates a problem of Adunah in Israel.
Yeah. I don't know if this question has an answer, but in Ashkafa, you know, even if somebody murders somebody else, you know, obviously the person murdered did something wrong, but it was God's will that the person got murdered.
Yes.
So in this case, even though it seems cruel and unjust that this husband would not give his wife a divorce, now she's stuck in this situation where she never remarried, maybe she never had kids, and it's stuck now. But apparently, if you follow the same logic in Ashkafa in this area, then it's in God's plan for some reason that this wife stays alone.
Well,
I
would say that's not true. I would have to say that maybe it was God's plan that what was experienced was experienced. You can grow from it, learn from it, or something. But there's certainly no concept that you don't extricate yourself from a difficult situation because it must have been God's will that you're in there. That's like saying, you know, if I could escape from a concentration camp, you know, well, gee, if God wanted me to be here, I got to stay here. In other words, it's part of God's plan that we try to alleviate human misery, right? Same thing with illness, right? We don't say illness comes from God, therefore we don't intervene. Why God allows things that are on their face, evil or difficult, is a unanswerable question. But certainly it was never understood in Judaism to adopt a stance of passivity and quiescence.
Well, I don't mean that you don't try to. I'm just saying, but in the end, let's say one of these cases where you just, the husband, you can't get the husband, you give a thing,
well,
the wife is stuck for the rest of her life. She can't,
listen,
she can't get out of their situation.
If in the end of the day, there's nothing that can be done, then this falls within the category of the book of Job, of why do bad things happen to good people. In other words, this may be just another example of those things in life for which we don't have the answer. The Holocaust and suffering and illness, in other words, this is just another bad thing. However, in terms of our duty, we do have a duty to try to help people out of those bad situations. I mean, like everything else, you do it, what's the prayer of the alcoholic? Give me the...
Serenity.
The serenity to accept that what I can't change,
the
wisdom to change what I can, and the ability to know the difference, something of that nature. I mean, there is a concept. You change what you can.
The courage to change what you can,
right.
And the wisdom to know the difference.
Right. You change what you can, and you accept what you can't. But you still have to change what you can. All right, so that's in America, the Agunah problem is even worse. Because whatever a Beis Din says is not going to make a difference. Let's say the Beis Din says, you got to give a get. He just says no. There's very little a Beis Din in America can do, at least officially. Now, it is true, according to Halacha, once a Beis Din said you must give a get, she could hire the mafia and beat the guy up, and that would be proper. That would be proper, according to Halacha. It happens sometimes. There are people to contact. It's like a Jewish mafia, you know, and maybe the mafia is operating this as a sideline. But I do want to emphasize one halakhic point. It is crucial that you understand you can't bring out the mafia till the Beis Din has decided she is entitled to a get. Sometimes women hire the mafia without going to the Beis Din, and then the get is no good. Okay? And I want to say that the same criticism of the Beis Din in Israel can apply in America too, where the Beis Din is sometimes very reluctant to come to the conclusion that the woman is entitled to a get. So you'll have that same issue. But as I say, theoretically, the use of the mafia is illegal and it could result in imprisonment and everything else. And certainly any Beis Din that would officially say, go ahead and use the mafia, the Beis Din themselves could be arrested, right? So a Beis Din will issue an order, maybe, but they're not going to say how to enforce it. Now, the one thing a Beis Din could do, which may or may not be so great, is a Beis Din can declare that if a man refuses to give a get after they ordered him to give a get, he is excommunicated, etc. We shouldn't associate with him. We shouldn't be counted for a minion. So it depends, you know, when you have so many shoals and big communities and people don't hear about it, it's very easy for a man to find a shoal where he'll be comfortable. I know that some shoals have a policy, this is a good policy, that any person, man or woman, who disobeys the order of the Beit Din, get, but also not even get, just generally, is not entitled to synagogue membership and is not entitled to participate in any type of simcha in the shul. So for example, they couldn't make a bar mitzvah for their child in the shul or the like. And that is a way of forcing it. There was a case in Canada a few years ago. This is a very interesting case. A man refused to give a get to his wife. The Beis Din ordered him to do so. He refused. So the Beis Din couldn't do anything. Right? So what happened was all the woman's friends in the town announced that they were not going to the mikveh until he gave a get to his wife. Meaning there would be no... Yeah.
This is so, like that Greek play. That's right.
That's right. And what happened was the get was delivered within a week. So there are informal pressures that can be used sometimes. And sometimes they work, you know. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes you have to know how to be a little bit of a psychologist, because the hard sell is sometimes not the way to do it. Sometimes, you know, abusing the husband, embarrassing the husband, excommunicating the husband, sometimes is counterproductive, because there's a certain kamikaze mentality where the husband knows he's doing something evil, and there's almost like a desire for self-destruction. I'll take everybody down with me, you know. And what sometimes needs to be done is the opposite, building up the husband's ego and kind of befriending him, and as a result, through a softer approach. Now again, there's no unified answer for this. Sometimes you got to knock him on the head. Sometimes you have to take a midnight walk and go out for a cup of coffee. The whole psychological dimension as well. But still, as I say, there are many, many women who are agunas, and it's a difficult problem. So let me just mention some of... What time do you have? 4 o'clock?
7.
Okay. All right, so let me just begin. Maybe Sunday I'll finish it off. Maybe McGill will start on Monday. Because this is... I actually have a book on this. The one book that I wrote is on this issue of agunas. So something I could talk about a lot. But one of the things that people are considering, and people are doing right now, is trying to incorporate what is it called a prenuptial agreement. Prenuptial agreement means an agreement that is signed before the marriage, either under the chuppah or before the chuppah, or you can do it even after the marriage. It doesn't even have to be pre. To the effect that, as you said, the conservative movement actually had started, they had a prenuptial agreement. It's gone through various forms, but they first had a prenuptial agreement all the way back in 1938. It goes back very, very far. The reform movement, as far as I understand, would have no need for a prenuptial agreement, because the reform movement does not require a get for the dissolution of a marriage. They believe under the principle of the law of the state is the law, although I believe that's the correct application of it, that a get is not needed. Although I will say, to the credit of many reform, as they've become sensitized to the issue of mamzer, if someone later decides to become Orthodox, a number of Reformed clergy do encourage congregants to get a get, not as a religious matter, but just so their future children will not be adversely affected. It's pushed as a civil matter. Huh? Right, preservation of options. Right. And in that way, I want to say, the conservative movement is a greater danger than the Reform for this reason. The Reform movement does not do get. So consequently, if they encourage a congregant to go get a get, they will send the congregant typically to an Orthodox rabbi who will do a kosher get. The conservative movement, by contrast, does believe in the institution of get, and they do their own. Now, there's a grave problem there. If the conservative get is halachically kosher, once again, because of the witnesses issue. So ironically, a movement that doesn't believe in gets, but sends people off to do it anyway, is actually avoiding avoiding more problems than a movement that believes in get and does their own. But again, in many of those cases, we do have Rav Moshe's psak, that the first marriage wasn't valid, so that'll kind of be a lifesaver in that case as well. But anyway, the prenuptial agreement can take a lot of forms. Let's examine a simple form. Let's say, I promise to give my wife a get whenever this marriage is terminated civilly. Right? You can say, promise to give a get. Now, what would that accomplish? Why is that good? Well, what that does is the following. Man refuses to give his wife a get. Now, she could sue him in secular courts because he made a contract. When contracts are not kept, somebody can be taken to court. Now, generally speaking, what a court might do in such an area is the court might say, you are under court order to give your wife a get, or you'll go to jail. In other words, essentially, a get promise turns the court system of the United States into what you already have in Israel. In Israel, if a beis din orders you to give a get, you can be thrown in jail. In the United States, you can't because of separation of church and state. But if you make it into a contract, then you could be forced. So that's a very simple way, yeah. Sure.
How is it possible that a halakhic decision ends up in something like prison?
Yeah, well, the truth of the matter is it is halakhic in the sense that although halakha does not prescribe prison as a punishment for an aveira, but halakha recognizes imprisonment as a way of forcing a person to obey the decision of a beis din.
So it's not considered a punishment?
No, it's not a punishment. It's a way of putting pressure on someone to follow the decision of a beis din. This is not a punishment for the past. This is designed to pressure you in compliance. And halakha recognizes imprisonment as a means of securing compliance with Jewish law. Yeah.
I don't understand what he says before in the prenuptial agreement. He says, when exactly is the marriage, when did it start, when did it get? Like how can they determine when it gets to
the end? Well, the way it would be is the following. The way it would be is, you sign an agreement that says, I promise to give my wife a get whenever our marriage is civilly over, whenever we have a divorce.
But
now,
that has to go through the...
No. So what it means is, let's assume the man refuses to give his wife a get. So she goes to court, and the judge orders the man to give a get. Now, what does the judge order? The judge doesn't write a get, obviously. The judge says, I order you to go to the rabbinic court of Los Angeles on Tuesday, 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
This is the secular judge?
Yes, the secular judge. Because they agree to it. In other words, the contract says you agree to give a get. Usually they'll say something like, I agree to give a get under the supervision of the beis din of Los Angeles. Okay, so what's going to happen is, if you refuse to do that, the judge will order you go to the beis din of Los Angeles at 2 p.m. Monday, January 30th, and have them prepare a get that you give to your wife. And if you don't do that, you're going to go to jail. Right? That's what a judge could do. So the simplest type of prenuptial agreements is a promise to give a get. However, that prenuptial agreement is actually fatally flawed. That is not a valid prenuptial agreement. Let me explain why. Because it goes back to the fundamental principle that any coercion to force a guy to give a get, if a beis din hasn't determined that she's entitled to a get, is an invalid get. So to simply have a judge order me to go to a beis din and write a get, who says the beis din is going to say that she's entitled to it, based on the abuse and everything else? So consequently, that simple prenuptial agreement would not be halakhically sufficient because it might result in a man writing a get under threat of imprisonment without a beis din ever saying she's entitled to it. So it would have to be modified with one extra line. You would say like this. You wouldn't say in the prenuptial agreement, I promise to give my wife a get whenever she wants it after a civil divorce. You have to say the following. I promise to go to a beis din and obey whatever decision they make. You see the difference? Instead of saying, I promise to give a get, you say it this way. I promise to abide by the decision of the Beis Din. So now it turns out the following. If the Beis Din determines she is entitled to a get, and they order you to give a get, and you don't, then the judge could halachically throw you in jail, because that is pressure on you to obey the decision of the Beis Din. Do you see the point? The point is, pressure is permitted if it is to obey the decision of a Beis Din. Pressure is not permitted if there's no Beis Din decision that she's entitled to a get. So the problem with the first variation of agreement was it simply said the judge could put me in jail for not giving her a get, even if a Beis Din might not have agreed that she's entitled to a get. The second way allows the judge, through the agreement, to impose pressure on me only if I don't obey the Beis Din. Of course, the problem is that by definition makes it a less effective from a woman's perspective, because who says she'll be able to go to, who says the Beis Din will find that she's entitled to a get? See, the first way would have protected any woman who wanted a get. But ironically, there's a halachic problem with that. The second way will protect fewer women, but in a halachically appropriate way. Yeah.
She requests a divorce. He agrees, but Bateman says this is not really right.
Yes. Let me explain this. If the husband is willing to give a get, then the Beis Din doesn't have to find she's entitled or not entitled. If they want to have a get by mutual consent, the Beis Din might discourage it, but the Beis Din does not have to find a grounds. But when must the Beis Din find grounds? Beis Din must find grounds when a man refuses to give a get to his wife. So the Beis Din can order him to give a get only if there are grounds, such as abuse or whatever it is. Okay? You don't need grounds where there's mutual consent. But the point I'm making is that for a judge to tell a man, you must write a get or I'm throwing you in jail, when a Beis Din has not found that there are grounds that could order him to do that, the get would be no good. And that is why the first type of prenuptial agreement is not halachically proper. The second type would be. Yeah.
Would adultery on the man's side be grounds for her requesting that?
Yes, that's a very excellent question. And according to many opinions, although as we discussed earlier, a married man committing adultery against his wife is not halachic adultery for mamzer purposes, but many have said at least habitual unfaithfulness. That's how you define that. Habitual unfaithfulness is a basis on which a woman would be entitled to an order that the man give her again, yeah, if she so desires.
I mean, that's just based on the decision that they have a wife.
No, it's not based on that. It's based on the fact that that's a form of abusing the woman and hurting the woman.
Habitual, I mean, you could have as many wives as you want, so what's
this is refers primarily to Ashkenazim. This is after the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom,
right.
Remember, right? So after the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom, a man who habitually cohabits with other women, even though it's not adultery, she could demand a get. Okay? So we'll discuss this on Sunday, some other variations, but it is important to keep in mind that a straight promise to give a get raises halachic problems of coercion, as opposed to a promise to obey the decision of a Beis Din does not, because that means coercion will be triggered only if the Beis Din issued an order. And that's going to be okay. The problem is, of course, that Beis Dins are reluctant to issue those orders, and therefore, you know, it's not going to work as much as it would otherwise do. Okay, so Sunday we'll continue with this, and then Monday we'll begin with Megillah.
He's got a couple questions.
Yeah.
We're just talking about the man who's being unfaithful. What
yes.
If a woman is an adulteress, and then a man, in order to, because he's angry and hurt, and he wants to hurt the woman, you know, to punish her for what he did, or what she did, would he be halachically allowed to just not give her again, let her sit and suffer for,
yeah.
Is there a concept like that?
No, actually the concept is the opposite. Actually, if a woman commits adultery, the man is obligated to divorce her. And even if he wants to stay married, he's not supposed to.
No, I mean, not stay married. Not be with her, but make her sit
He would actually be ordered to give her.
He would be ordered.
Yes,
okay.
He would be. Leaving her as a niguna is not justified.
Okay, and the last question is back to about this concept of hiring Vito, Corleone, thinking about it. Is there any other cases in halacha where you can actually, besides this case of the niguna, is there a case in halacha where you can actually go out and halachically hire the monkey or something to beat up somebody,
No. In other words, it's generally not allowed in private money. Somebody owes you money, you can't do that.
Or what if they steal from you and you can't get the civil system fails and there's
no way
back
court? I'm trying to think about this. There is a principle in halacha called self-help, meaning if this court system, if the basin is not helping you, you can resort to getting your own property back. The question is, are you allowed to use violence for that? I'd have to check. It's a possibility. But I think there's a concept of proportion here, meaning to say, you can't kill somebody, but you want
to
get back
beating them up to
beating
make
them up,
but
you want to get back $10. I mean, there has to be. Let me check on that.
What about the law of the state being the law? I mean, if Beit Din orders a get to issue, but it's illegal, it's a battery, it's a criminal and civil, action.
Yeah.
You can still.
That's an interesting question. That goes back to the question we discussed earlier. If the law of the land is the law, exists in the relationship between Jew and Jew. If you say between Jew and Jew, it is only the law of the Torah that governs, then I can hit you, even if the law of the land prohibits it. I'm sorry, you have a case? Yeah. Right. Yes. I assume these are off-duty cops, or it's very nice when you have that type of informal cooperation between the base and the police. Things can work out well, but as I say, there is a whole question whether, as between Jew and Jew, the law of the land does directly apply. But
there's a
machlokas among the commentators. There's not a clear consensus about it. Yeah. Okay, but we'll talk about it again on Sunday.
Classical halacha. So,
a conservative person on Saturday night post said you're allowed to drive Shabbos shots or otherwise, because it's more advantage for them to have full Shabbos shots. So we'll see what
right.
Of course, that's a different question. Yeah. The question is, does one get invalidated merely because of affiliation as opposed to practice? Moshe seems to be upset. The near affiliation of the movements is qualification. Then rather say no. Although Aaron's foundation, his brother, seems to say that if you're not doing any actions, you're getting to work.
Just the television said that it's better not to go to the conservative show on the not to get any show in, apparently. That's good.
His brother commutes between Chicago and New York.
Oh, yeah.
Or Chicago and New York.
Oh.
So his brother's
how old?
He's an older brother since his 80s.
Wow.
That's good.
Okay, Rob.
Okay,
thank you.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. Always appreciate it.